This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 66, for the week of June 22nd, 2009, Hamel with a Side of Sass. This week, Dave and Larry interview Dan Navarra. Dan's a designer who works with new technologies, Hamel and Sass, which are markup alternatives for HTML and CSS. Let's listen to the interview.
So we're here at, where are we at? We're at JJ's?
J&C Inn. I think it's got another name, like Bacina.
We're at 548 West Van Buren. That's all I know. Mm-mm. So this is a joint.
This is a great joint. Like a lot of history on the walls, a lot of history in the food. It's
but
a
wait,
great
wait, who am
be.
I talking to? Dan.
Dan Navarra.
Dan Navarra, how you doing, man?
Good.
So introduce yourself. We met you at Code Camp a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm a front ender extraordinaire. My focus is right
front
now.
Front bumpers, back bumpers, yeah. So a little bit of auto body.
Yeah.
Okay.
I get in everywhere.
Yeah. We're talking about websites.
Websites. Yeah. I do a lot of Rails development. A lot of CSS, XHTML, JavaScript. Master in the last three. And get into like programming in almost every language imaginable.
Nice. So, yeah. So actually, we met you at the Chicago Code Camp a couple weeks ago, Larry and myself, and you did a session on Hamel.
Yes.
And Sass, did they pronounce it Sass or just
Hamel,
S?
Sass, and Template, which is a framework I'm building on top of Sass.
Okay. So what's this Hamel thing? I mean, before I saw your session, I didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
And now I'm kind of blown away.
Hamel's a really awesome way to start redoing your views. If you take your average programming language, you know, front-end scripting code, and you look at the pages, it usually looks like a mess, right? You've got...
That's if the IDE is nice to you.
Exactly.
It looks like a mess if the IDE is nice, and
exactly.
If the IDE is not nice, it can really be a mess, right?
So what Hamel does is it's an interpreter that basically uses whitespace to draw out your markup code.
So Larry Whitespace, your favorite, right?
Oh, we'll talk about whitespace in a minute, but...
Well, here's the thing. At first, the whitespace wasn't very exciting to me, but once you realize you're forced to have a standard and that everybody on the project can't argue about six spaces versus two spaces versus...
Or tabs versus
tabs
five
versus,
spaces.
Right.
So hate that guy.
You're stuck with two spaces. That's it. You can't do anything else. If you indent improperly, your markup throws an error.
All right, we'll go ahead and talk about it, Dave. You know, that I worked with a white space language in college.
Mm-hmm.
It was a naturally looping language.
Okay.
So you would say like the verb read, right? It would read everything in the entire file at that point, just that one line of code. But it was very white space sensitive, so that the loop constructs were based on, you know, the tabs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first saw in Hamel, which is a .NET implementation of Hamel, they're pretty much the same. As we've had a side conversation about that. The first time I saw that, I was like, oh, that's a very pretty, elegant style of markup, because you had a div or the Hamel tag that gave you the div, but you didn't have to close it because the fact that you indented back out closed it naturally. Right.
Everything that's indented inside gets encapsulated in that div.
Right. It made the page very brief, very readable. And I thought to myself, I am one tab away from disaster. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think that's one of the most beautiful things about Hamel.
Actually, first, I don't even think we described it yet, have we?
So, I guess not.
So the whole idea is that there's this special markup that generates your HTML.
Right.
Okay.
And it's two tabs for indentation. Elements, HTML elements are, if it's a class, it's dot element name, and that throws a class name in. If it's an ID, it's pound element ID, and that'll throw in.
So the idea, it's kind of like shorthand that gets put through some sort of parsing engine before it gets rendered out to the browser.
And the beauty, too, is the parsing engine is faster than, in Rails, it's faster than regular ERBs. In Hamel, it's faster than parsing, or in Hamel, it's faster than parsing .NET pages.
And this was actually born out of the Rails community?
Yeah.
Okay.
Out of the Ruby community. It's
okay.
Gem. Yeah.
All right.
And where was I before that? Oh, so the beauty is that being a front-end guy, I've always been really into semantic code, into validating my code, into making my markup as clean and as beautiful as possible. And what you get with Hamel is you can allow back-end guys who don't know what they're writing as far as HTML to write a Hamel page, and all of a sudden, if they aren't properly closing a tag, it's going to explode on them. They're going to get an error. There's no way for anybody to write bad markup with it unless you try as hard as you possibly can.
Oh, we should put Dave and Larry in the case. We'll give it a run.
All right.
Dan, we'll try. We'll be your unit test case. So.
Oh, perfect.
Can we talk a little bit about the guts of what's happening here? Or did you have a thought to finish?
No, no. Go ahead.
What actually happens is that there's a request, you know, at a URI, mm-hmm. and something on the web server is going to grab the HAML and do the interpretation of it.
Right.
Is that a C++ module? Is it on the IIS, we call it an ISAPI filter?
Right. Well,
is it a CGI implementation?
Right. So I'm familiar with the Ruby version, obviously.
Okay.
So we're talking about a Ruby gem in that instance. I'm not sure what they use in NHAML exactly. But the Ruby gem, any Ruby server is basically going to have Ruby installed or JRuby installed, and then it just interprets it on that side at runtime.
Okay. So it's not some kind of native module.
Or is it written in Ruby?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it also has its counterpart SAS, which we haven't really mentioned yet, which is the HAML for CSS, which is another really incredible language.
Okay, let's talk about that, because, and I'll tell you this, that one of the, I think CSS is absolutely wonderful. I jumped on the CSS bandwagon back in the 90s when it was terribly broken.
Right.
And it's only gotten better, you know, as we've gotten more better consistent support for it, right?
Oh,
so I've been a big fan of CSS from the beginning. One of the things that has always been wonky about the CSS experience is that it's a separate thing from the HTML, which mm-hmm. is good, right? But it was very hard to tie things together. Now, you can do things in the IDE to, like, you know, if you're implementing a class, like, let's say you're a bad developer like Larry, and you spell the name of the class incorrectly. You know, like Dan told me, you know, use head, and I just typed out. I said HAED, right? And
right.
I misspelled it. The IDE can tell you, like, hey, this class doesn't exist in the CSS file that you've referenced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go fix it. You know, or some IDEs will let you add there. But I've always felt that there was some kind of linkage really missing between there. Does this help solve that?
It doesn't really solve that so much. It solves some other interesting problems people have had with CSS from the beginning. One of my favorite things about it is you can truly create object-oriented CSS.
Ooh, real inheritance?
Yeah. As real as you're going to get with a language like this, but they have what's called mixins, which are basically small functions. So one of the things that I use it most commonly for is clearfix. Anybody who's a front-end guy knows what that is. Different browsers handle the box model differently, and you have to assign elements with breaks after objects. So you can create a mixin that has all of your CSS code to generate your float and your object after and everything else after. And then in any CSS object inside your SAS file, you can just add plus that mixin name, and it just throws all of that CSS code into that object. So you're reusing big chunks of code very easily.
Right. So once again, shorthand to kind of these lengthy things that we have to define.
Right.
So the question I have, you know, from a development standpoint, I can get it, right? I can wrap mm-hmm. my arms around this. It's just another sort of language that's going to give me an end result. You mm-hmm. know, and that end result is my HTML page.
Right.
So the question I have for you is, how do designers appreciate sort of HAML and SAS, and do they wrap their arms around it, or are they just fight kicking and screaming because they're used to HTML? They know
HTML. I've seen 50-50 results. And I actually have a design background myself. I moved into HAML on a project where I was, like, my main role was design and front-end coding.
Okay.
So I was skeptical at first. You know, being an HTML purist and not knowing what the heck this interpreter was going to do, and is it going to forget to close a tag or not validate or whatever.
It's got to do it right. Yeah.
I put it through. I put it through the motions pretty well and just tested things out and viewed the source. It does so many beautiful things. So when you view the source on a HAML page, you know how normally you've got all your files and includes and whatever, and you view the source and you've got something indented like maybe 37 spaces to the left because it's an include and it's indented in the include and in wherever. In HAML, because it's white space sensitive, basically everything just lines up exactly how you would expect it to if you were writing flat HTML yourself.
Right.
So perfect indentation. You can actually change HAML preferences to decide if you want all of your HTML to appear on one line or to be indented four spaces. Your CSS, too, you can clean out all the white space on it and make it run completely smoothly.
Right. So it's unfortunate this is an audio only podcast, right?
Yeah.
Because I think there's probably a lot of people that are listening are probably like, they're not understanding what this language looks like, per se.
Exactly.
So I guess what would be like a simple example if we were to define like a div tag that contains some sort of content?
Yeah, I mean, a great. Let's talk about a simple div that, you know, has an ID of, you know, div one, and you have to add two classes to that div. Plus, you have a paragraph and an anchor tag nested inside there, right? So in your standard div, you can go anywhere. You've got your opening bracket, your div, your ID equals your closing bracket. You get a jumble of your paragraph and your anchor tag, and who knows if it's nested improperly and, you know, it's not XML compliant or it's not XHTML compliant,
right,
and you get errors. In HAML, you'd have your ID of div 1, so just pound div 1, and dot whatever your class
names
are. Is it
pound 1 or pound div 1?
Pound div 1.
Okay.
So that would actually, if you type pound div 1 and then interpret it, it would interpret div ID equals div 1.
Okay.
And then dot whatever you want a class name to be, that'll just get thrown in there as a class. And then you'd hit enter, tab in once, and hit like percent %P. And whatever you want inside the paragraph tag.
So pound, so div one is the actual ID, not that we're saying
pound
is related to div.
And maybe saying div was a little confusing. It could have foo, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So pound foo one dot, you know, whatever class.
Yeah.
So pound is relating to an ID,
which matches it up with the CSS beautifully too. So when you see the pound in your HAML and the pound in your SAS, it's talking to the same thing, which is kind of what you were talking about, but not as clean.
Yeah, so, and then also then the dot is then also analogous to CSS where it relates to the class name.
Exactly.
Cool. So what about form tags and like input tags and stuff like that?
Just as easy. And you can use your standard language helpers as well to generate your form tags. But, you know, any percent with any word after it is going to generate that tag.
Okay.
And you can use curly braces and throw whatever attributes you want in there in a hash. And that'll just show up if you can't find a simple HAML way of doing it. Still clean, still easy to read, still flows pretty normal.
And when I look at a generated page, the first thing I should see on a page, browsers are still forgiving about this, is the DTD definition. By default, does HAML generate the XHTML strict or...
Whatever you want, but it's so much easier with HAML. Just like exclamation point strict is going to generate that entire DTD guy for you. Or just XML is going to give you the XML or transitional. It's very smart about grabbing the document types and writing them out for you.
When you get down to a tag, like an image tag, for instance, if you've got transitional, and I think it's the loose definition, that doesn't close the image tag.
Right.
Okay. I'm looking at you to confirm that I'm saying the right thing.
Occasionally,
I just make up stuff on this show.
No, no. It grasps that for you, which is beautiful.
And it won't close it in that case.
You get so much more help.
If I go back to the top and I change that to XHTML strict, that same tag, I haven't changed my markup at all, will now start generating the self-closing tag. That's hot.
Yeah, it is.
So actually what I would ask is, you know, people that are, once again, I kind of go back out, and so people are listening to this, you know, why don't we explain what, you know, HTML strict versus XHTML is, just real quick. Go for it, Larry.
Well, on any document, if you look at any XML document, it's an optional parameter, but the first thing is the specification, you know, and it can be expressed as a schema in XML or a DTD. And with HTML, it's always a DTD. And that basically defines the structure of the document itself. The browser is going... The tool that you use to create the markup and the browser, most of them are going to respect and honor that and tell you when you're violating that, or in the case of the browser, it's going to use that as its guide to actually parsing it.
Right.
So if you say at the top of it that this is an XHTML strict document, that you should follow all the rules of XML. So single elements should be self-closed, for instance. You have to... You know, make sure if you open a tag that you close it.
And nest it properly.
Right. And then the additional step is there are requirements for how things are named. For instance, XHTML strict requires the image tag to be lowercase, right? IMG. If you go back to the
and
older...
And have an alt attribute and be self-closing.
Right. So there's a set of rules that you're... When you, as the person developing the page, when you say this is an XHTML strict, it's almost a contract between you and whoever's consuming it that you're going to follow these rules. Now, the reality is the browsers are still very kind to people.
Somewhat forgiving. But it's also that's also a problem, too, because all of a sudden you get thrown into quirks mode and everything on your page starts behaving a little bit differently. And, you know, it's best to follow the rules.
And so quirks mode is?
That's basically when a browser says, I don't understand what document type you're throwing at me, and it's not behaving how I think it should. So I'm going to try to be as forgiving as possible and lay out things as well as possible.
Right, so the browser, those little things at the top of your page, you know, those doc types and stuff, those are important because that helps the browser determine how it's supposed to render the page.
Exactly. And if it doesn't know, it'll throw itself into quirks mode, and then it says, I'm just going to try to use everything I possibly can to make it work.
And here's the bonus tip for the Thirsty Developer listeners today, is that if your browser picks up on the doc type and it doesn't throw itself into quirks mode and it validates properly to that, it's going to perform a lot faster. The browser's not going to have to do a lot of work. Because if you talk about the instance where I say it's a strict definition and the browser finds that it's not and it goes into quirks mode, it's going to restart. It's going to start processing over. Again, your look and feel, your browser is going to be, your look and feel, your page is going to be different. But more than that, it's going to take extra time. Now, that's on the client.
Exactly.
It's not as bad as something on the server, but.
And in development.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to be jumping through hoops that you normally wouldn't have to.
We should mention, and I hope everybody listening to the show is aware of that, but the W3C validators, great set of tools out on the internet. There are validators for HTML, and there's validators for CSS, both. So you can actually, you can upload CSS or you can point the validator at a URL if you've got a you know, you've got your markup facing the public, and it'll tell you each and every error on that page, not just the structural errors that you would get normally, but also does it validate to the DTD that you specified? And that's something that right before you finish deploying your application, you really should run that final check because it's really easy to break. Unless you're using something like NHAML, right?
Exactly. Well, and that's...
We're back to NHAML.
Or HAML.
Either way, though. I mean, you're going to be so much happier. And none of these things are perfect, and you're still going to have to police to a certain extent. But it's so much easier to design just standards-compliant, posh, clean markup and HTML. One of the other things I haven't mentioned yet about the SAS component of HAML is... variables in your CSS, which is pretty huge. My framework that I've been working on uses like standard variables for page width, font size, line height, etc. And you can do entire document calculations based on that using the mixins and whatever you want. So you could say, hey, my document's width is 960 pixels. I want two columns. Let's divide 960 by two and create the columns that way.
So what would that look like exactly? So and utilizing these variables, is it just setting a value and that's just being propagated on down to the definition?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Like exclamation point variable name is how you'd set them.
Oh, cool. Yeah. All right.
And the great thing is you can do math in the CSS, and you can also do math on colors, which is really interesting. So you can do like blue times red if you want, you know. Well, with, you know, like pound 369 plus.
Now is that a real number? We're going to test you after this.
369 would be like a blue-gray. 900 would be a dark red.
Nice.
You can multiply those guys by each other.
So actually, that kind of brings up a question I have. I've been kind of getting on the bandwagon of looking into design and sort of learning the sort of tricks of the trade, if you will. Can you do math on color definitions against like sort of the color wheel? Is that possible?
Yeah, you can. I was actually trying it in my framework. You can get some really interesting results that way, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes the perfect complement to a color isn't necessarily what you want to have thrown in across your web page.
Right.
But it's definitely possible and kind of cool and easy to do.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really fun, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And you really have to choose your palette well if you're going to do it.
Right.
Which it'd probably be fun to write a little framework that does like complements or triads or split triads and can, you know, break things down that way.
So you mentioned your framework a couple of times, mm-hmm. but have you really talked about what your framework is?
My framework is called Tenplate. It's not an M, that's a N.
Like T-E in the number,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. The concept is, it's similar to something like blueprint.css or 960.css. And there's actually another Haml SAS framework out there called Compass that's really nice. That's actually using both of those together in SAS. Mine's kind of a competitor to it, but I think it's also different because I'm creating a much slimmer framework that's more targeted towards somebody who just wants to set a couple of base document values and have their columns and everything else automatically calculated based on that. And it'll set a layout grid for you based on a 12 column grid, and you know, you get whatever percentages you want, like 1/3, 2/3, the golden ratio, whatever column sizes you want. Plus you get what's called a typography grid, which basically lines up all of your fonts and type in the site to a baseline, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
Really helps the human eye read and like walk through the page. Template also has form helpers for Rails, which will help line up your forms along that same grid, which if you watch a user try to interact with a form, if it's cleaner and if it's spaced, you know, lined one above the other, you'll notice a savings of like 6 seconds on the average user working through a form. It's pretty amazing.
6 seconds doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're writing an application for a call center of like 3,000 people,
right.
6 seconds per page, that's like millions of dollars.
Pretty amazing.
That gets huge very fast.
Yeah. You know? And it's also beautiful to like watch the eye tracking on something like that. These crazy zigzags move to like a nice fluid column, you know?
So we kind of threw quite a few things out there. So we got Haml, mm-hmm. we got SAS, and now we got Tenplate.
Okay.
So as a developer/designer, front-end developer, how do I sort of pull all these together to sort of define, you know, my page?
Oh, cool. Well, that's an interesting thing. Tenplate is still in beta right now, but I'm working on a simple web app.
Isn't everything on the web in beta?
In beta,
essentially.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's just like Gmail, right? So I'm writing a web app that will allow you to enter basically a couple of template options,
mm-hmm.
so your page width, your line height, your font size, your font style, and what kind of basic columns you want,
mm-hmm.
and that'll automatically generate the CSS and markup for you. Anybody can download the project from GitHub.
All right, so we're back. So just to kind of give you just what happened, we got kicked out of our little favorite dining establishment there. So now we're around the corner of Starbucks.
Yeah, we got a little too rowdy.
Exactly.
They hate
roughing
all that
up
crazy
the
code talk.
That's right. So so where were we? We were talking about sort of bringing Haml and SAS and your framework together,
exactly.
and sort of producing these applications.
So I mentioned where you could get my framework, which is up at github.com. You can also grab Haml from GitHub too. It's a Git project as well, but I think haml.southampton.com is the official website, and that'll give you lots of information about the different ports. I know besides nhaml, there's also a PHP port. I believe there's a Python port for Django and a couple
we'll,
other.
We'll have links to this, you know, in the show notes, so people can just go to thirstydeveloper.com to this episode. We'll have links there so people can go check it out.
Perfect. I do, like, even if you are skeptical, I do recommend giving it a try because, like I said, I was really opposed to the idea when I first started using it. Now I go back to any other language, and I was working with JSPs today, just like, oh my gosh, what is this mess? It looks like somebody threw up on my page. And I don't know where to find anything.
Yes, you have to help me. I'm still confused of, like, you know, bringing all these together. So, you know, if you look at the different types of applications or websites that you're building. So, like,
okay.
Let's say, you know, there's your typical blogging example. There's your typical marketing page,
uh-huh.
that just provides product, you know, information. There's your maybe sort of like a line of business application page. I mean, do these technologies fit in sort of all those scenarios?
Oh, absolutely. But I think where you're going to find most people start adopting Haml and SAS is in MVC-style frameworks, and they let the Haml part focus on the view,
okay.
and become like what the view of your application is.
Right.
So it's going to replace, in Rails, it replaces ERBs. And what would the .NET equivalent be of your
just
layout
like web
page?
Forms. And,
yeah, exactly.
Yep.
So it's just going to make that a lot prettier, make it white space dependent, make it so when you as a developer look at it and as a designer looks at it, they're like, wow, I understand what's going on here. It's like so fluid, it flows, it makes sense, it's pretty.
Right. It's just another way of understanding the syntax. So if we get down sort of the brass tactics of it all, it's really about, you know, sort of defining what your presentation looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You do a sort of in a shorthand syntax.
Yep.
There's a module in the middle, whatever that is, iSAPI filter or gem module or something,
right,
that converts sort of that language and outputs this HTML, depending, you know, how we define it.
Exactly. Okay. And you can do beautiful things like in your development environment, have it output indented HTML that's easy for the developer to read.
Right.
And then once you go to production, throw all the HTML on one line so you get a quicker get and a little smaller file size.
Now, here's a question now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what about JavaScript? I mean, does it make it harder to work with JavaScript when you're integrating with the HAML?
There's JavaScript built-ins. So JavaScript colon and then everything indented past that point would be JavaScript. And you can. There's also, for other languages or other things that you can't quite fit in, there's a plain tag that you can throw.
Kind of like
there.
A pre, you
yeah,
know, that
exactly.
just says, don't mess with this, please.
Anything below this point.
I think for the most part that JavaScript inclusion is not an issue because we all know now that you shouldn't have
separate
JavaScript inline in the page for the most part. You know, that you should, all you need to do is reference the file that's on the server.
Exactly.
And you get better caching.
But the way that we're in our MVC layouts that we're using a lot right now, I still have my JavaScripts included in an onReady tag that's separate from the layout but still in each individual layout page. So you're just getting the script specific to that page, you know.
So I'm trying to think of some examples so people can really wrap their head around this and understand the power
mm-hmm.
of the interpretation here, especially with the math.
Well, that is another reason I really wish this was visual, because when you can see a page that has your standard markup in whatever language versus the HAML alternative, you're just like, wow, I just lost, you know, 15 lines of code and everything is so much cleaner and easier to read.
So what we can do is in the show notes, we'll mm-hmm. put a link to an example of that, of a before and after page. Maybe you could help us put one together.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But from the math standpoint,
mm-hmm.
Dave and I, a couple of years ago, we got to see Eric Meyer, the CSS genius,
mm-hmm.
Do a presentation here in Chicago at an event apart. And he talked about using CSS to dynamically do bar graphs.
Okay.
And one of the things that was so challenging, you understood how he was doing, you know, the CSS reset in there. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, doesn't matter what the individual browsers do, I'm going to do a reset on there. And then you understood how, you know, he would lay out things, mm-hmm. right? But he did that thing that a lot of presenters do, and I do it myself, right? That the actual implementation of the CSS to do the math on what your bar graph actually looks like is best left to the reader, you know? And as far as I know, there's not a lot of frameworks that'll let you do the math on the CSS.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right now, SAS is one of the only ones I know that allows you to do math inside CSS. I think I saw a posting on Aristopart or Zeldman or something like that about a new up-and-coming one, but it's still pretty hard to find. And generally, if you want to do that sort of thing, you're usually writing your CSS in, you know, whatever language you're using on the server and having it spit something out, which isn't fun for anyone.
Right. So speaking of event apart, I actually just saw that they're coming back to Chicago in October. So I'll definitely be hitting that one up.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, we kind of talked about, you know, you said there's different versions of this HAML. Is it a framework? Do you call it a framework or is it a language? What
you
is
know,
it?
It's a really good question. I'm not sure exactly what you would call it. An interpreter?
Yeah.
You know,
it's like almost like another programming language in
yeah.
a sense. But
let's call it a life changer.
So, you know, I know earlier we kind of talked about the designers and you know, uh-huh. getting designers on board. And yes, you may be hearing there's Frappuccinos being made in the background if you probably do hear this. But, you know, we talked about the designers. Did we ever answer that question? Or, you know, you said 50-50. What do we have to do to talk to our designers to sort of get them on board with this? Is it just a matter of education?
It is. And it's a matter of letting them know that once they get in front of it, that it's very intuitive. And that if you know your HTML or any standard markup, it's going to flow pretty easily outside of that. I mean, it took me all of one day to pick up HAML and like start
right.
loving it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the average person who doesn't even know that much HTML could, you know, by the end of a week, be completely comfortable inside of HAML.
Right. Cool. So actually,
and if you go back to my earlier arguments about how you can't break the markup, you can't improperly nest things, you're
once again
you're forced
put it through
into
the Dave
standard.
And Larry test. We'll see if we can do that.
Yeah. But and we'll put that example up on the blog too, right?
But what kind of intrigues me? You're a Linux guy,
yeah,
right? So, you know, of course, you know me being a PC,
right?
I just kind of understanding, you know, what does your environment look like? What tools are you using to develop all this stuff?
I usually use GNOME Edit, gedit, or Vim to do my development.
Okay,
but I bounce between IDEs as well. There are Haml plugins for Eclipse, NetBeans. Most major IDEs will have a plugin for.
So they give you IntelliSense, syntax highlighting, that kind
syntax
of
highlighting, code completion, like all okay. that kind of good stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think RadRails, the Aptana's Rails development environment.
Okay, yeah, Aptana.
Actually, yeah, it's Aptana now, yep. Isn't it? Yeah, I think that has a pretty sweet Haml plugin now that works pretty well.
So do you see this as like something that's going to be taken off, or is it starting to get steam? Or
it's starting to get steam. I'm seeing a lot more people adopt it. I think if you get a developer or designer in front of it, they're either going to fall madly in love with it or shy away from even trying. But generally, I see people fall madly in love with it. Optiva, the company that I'm working with, is using it on a good majority of our projects now. And I mean, a couple of our other developers are trying to bring it into projects that they're on, too, just to kind of spread the word, the love.
Right. Looking at wrapping this up here, just kind of where should they go? I mean, we kind of pinpointed some sites.
Right.
And we'll kind of, you know, try to aggregate all that and put it on the part of the podcast here. But where do we reach you? Have you got a blog? Any other resources you want to share?
You can visit my blog at pinmonkey.com. I'll throw a couple of links up there.
Pinmonkey.com.
Pinmonkey.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the story behind that blog? You told me this story.
Yeah. I don't really remember where it came from. I think I was looking for something else, monkey.com. I've had the domain since like 95, 96. And, you know, Pin Monkey, us guys who do the grunt work, set the pins up at the bowling alley. Like,
that's great. And the URL was available, right?
And the URL was available. Exactly.
Great. So pinmonkey.com and anything else? Any other resources, speaking gigs you got coming up?
I don't have any gigs scheduled right now, but I've got a couple of proposals out there, so I'll be sure to let you guys know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next. And we are planning a Chicago Code Camp for later this summer, too. A bar camp.
Bar camp, yep.
So I'll let you guys know as soon as that's happening, too.
Definitely. All right, Dan. Well, thanks for being on Thirsty Developer. Uh-huh. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So that was a fun episode, Dave. I especially like the part where we got kicked out of the place
Until we got kicked out, yeah.
Yeah. But Dan's a phenomenal. He called himself a front ender.
Yeah,
you know it's so interesting how that's evolved, because it used to be, you know, back in the day, as you like to say, when we started, you know, the front end guy did his stuff in Photoshop and then just passed it on to you as the developer.
Right.
Now it seems like, you know, we're getting tools that both developers and designers can work well with together.
Right.
And you know, like XAML's a great example of that, but it looks like, you know, there are people taking a serious look at the actual HTML markup and saying there's better ways to generate this.
Well, what I fear is, you know, you just said it's XAML. I'm like, no, Larry, it's Haml. Oh, wait, there is a XAML. There's also an in Haml, right? But you
there's
know,
a
of
lot
course,
of solutions to the same problem.
Of course,
yeah.
You know, Haml is for pure, you know, it's a shorthand for building, you know, out HTML markup. You know, XAML is just declarative language around, you know, sort of WPF and serverless applications. In Haml is sort of the .NET version of Haml and stuff. So I mean, yeah, there's kind of you kind of get some confusion with the naming here, but you know, like I said, it is they're all solving the same problem.
So Dave,
yes,
what are your challenges in the front end?
It's really comes down to, you know, making developers more productive, I think, and that's I think when we start looking at these languages, you know, when they start getting wordy, right? You look at HTML and it's just like brackets and, you know, attributes and quotation marks, and it gets very wordy because that's what standard, you know, to be a well-formed XML document, which essentially what it's trying to be, especially in XHTML, is it gets very wordy. And so, you know, if you don't have the right tools, you know, you're typing a lot of code in there. So I think, you know, when people start introducing these new sort of language constructs and put them through certain parsing engines, essentially they're trying to save themselves some time. Some typing, some coding efforts, but you know there is a learning curve, right? Like we talked about, it's like you got to get the designers to buy in so they can understand what's getting generated from this code.
I still think one of the issues that I struggle with is the fact that you have the markup, whether it's generated by just pure HTML sitting on the web server, whether it's done with HAML or with a combination approach like ASP.NET's got, right? Because ASP.NET's got traditional markup, but then server-side markup that gets rendered into client-side markup before it actually is sent out. You've got that. You've got the CSS, which is a separate paradigm.
Yep.
And then you've also got the graphics layer on top of it. And I'm not even throwing in technologies like Silverlight and Flash right now. I'm talking about just the standards-based web. Throw JavaScript in there, and you've got yet another pivot on there. There's a lot.
And look, and now we're starting to hear inklings about HTML5, and that's just a whole other sort of ball of wax, if you will.
Actually, we've got a great interview coming up that we're scheduling with a guy who's got a lot of insight on what HTML5 is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we should have that within a few weeks of the show.
So now we committed to it. So now you have to deliver. Well, be careful what you say on tape, Larry.
Well, we're working out the schedule, so we'll have it'll be a conversation about jQuery,
mm-hmm.
but I think we're going to talk a lot about HTML5 and what it brings and how it changes frameworks.
Right, right. But I mean, that's just another thing you have to look forward. You know, sort of that's going to be coming down the road, whether that's a year or two out. But it's just another one that it's an evolution of HTML, but it's still sort of that another presentation layer thing that you're going to have to learn.
We live in really interesting times, Dave. And
you're not going to get all sassy on me right here,
yeah,
philosophical.
Sassy, yeah. Going back to the interview. I think that every couple of years, you know, we go through just this influx of new technologies. And then, once we get our heads around it, then we think, all right, that'll be the last one for a while.
Exactly.
And then it happens all over again. And by the way, there's a PDC in the fall. As if the last PDC wasn't enough. So.
Right, exactly.
But it's really interesting, and I think that I'm personally starting to pay more attention to the front end.
So, Larry, you say you're more of a front-end guy than a back-end guy?
I'm definitely not a front-end guy. I'm starting to appreciate what the front-end brings. I used to take great pride in the fact that I was the guy that did the back-end of the system.
Right.
That I used to tell people, it's like, when the hourglass pops up for a second and then goes away?
That's what I do. That's great.
I used to take great pride in that because, I would have, 700 objects firing off every time the person hit the OK button, right? And, talked about multi-tier and distributed transactions and all that. The reality is that if you're not paying attention to the front end, nobody really cares how elegant the back end is.
Yep.
So I'm starting to appreciate the, not just the look and feel of it, because it's really easy to pick a nice color scheme. Well, it's easy for other people. It's not easy for me. But I'm starting to appreciate how a good front end, is so important. Good buddy of mine, up in Milwaukee, Steve Schmidt, actually talked about this. He said that the architect, when they see an application, they see presentation tier, business tier, data tier, a types library. You see the architecture of the application.
Mm-hmm.
What the front end, what the end user sees is the front end and magic.
Nice.
That everything that's not happening on the front end is magic. So that's their entire view into the application. So it better be pleasing and it better be usable.
I kind of like that. It's like David Copperfield-like. Watch what happens when I push this button.
Well, with that, we should really wrap up the show.
I think so.
You guys have a good week.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time. What are your challenges in the front end?
I suppose I could drop a few pounds. Oh, I'm sorry.